Peter. Well, once again, we have lots of faces in our courtroom this morning. Looks like we have some students here. My notes say, is it Charis? Is that
Harris?
Harris, okay. Classical Academy students from Madison. If you're here, will you all please stand? Oh, that's very nice. Thank you very much. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with. So they will know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us now. Students and your advisors, and anybody else who's interested too, if you can remain after we conclude this hearing, Justice Ryan Hagedorn, who sits down there at the end of the bench, will come down and talk with you a little bit about how cases come to the Supreme Court. He won't talk to you about the merits or the substance of the case you're about to hear, but I think you'll have a lot to talk about. So if you can stay, please do. And with that brief announcement, I will call our second case of the day, State versus Harrison. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
May it please the court. I am Jennifer Remington, and I represent the state. This case is about how a court should credit time spent in confinement on a conviction that is later vacated. There are two statutes that govern the outcome in this case. Section 973.155, which governs sentence credit generally, and Section 973.04, which governs credit for a vacated sentence. The Court of Appeals sidestepped those statutes when it created a judicial remedy, an advancement concept. Because Harrison is not entitled to credit under the statutes, and because an advancement concept rewards habitual offenders and creates confusion, this court should issue a substantive opinion reversing the Court of Appeals' decision.
Counsel, do you agree that when a conviction is vacated, it's as if it never occurred?
Your Honor, I would not agree that it's as if it never occurred. I would say that once a conviction is vacated, that conviction is rendered void, and at the moment that it is rendered void, it has no further effect from that point forward.
So, in this case, having served time on the conviction that was then vacated, you see no way. What the Court of Appeals tried to do was put the person back to where they would have been had the conviction not occurred.
I would agree that what the Court of Appeals tried to do was what the court perceived as being fair. And I would say that what the court did was not contemplated by the legislature, because as previously stated, there are two credit statutes that govern this case.
Right, and I get that, and I agree with the statutory analysis of credit statutes. But the question remains, and I think it's would be maybe not even this case, but a very narrow context where you have two consecutive sentences, one after the other, if one of those is vacated but the time has then been served already on that sentence, how do you reconcile that, knowing that the person then has to serve the next sentence starting at the end of a sentence they shouldn't have served in the first place, essentially? Isn't there a way to reconcile that when you have consecutive sentences?
Your Honor, there's not a way to reconcile that. That does not conflict with the legislature's determination about when credit is to be rewarded. And on top of that, there are three reasons why it would be inappropriate for this court to adopt an advancement concept. And so I'll go ahead and list those three reasons and then discuss each in detail. First, an advancement concept rewards habitual offenders. Second, it conflicts with our bifurcated sentencing structure. And third, it encourages courts to forego application of 973.04. So returning to the first reason that this court should not adopt advancement, which is because it rewards habitual offenders, advancement only benefits those who have multiple convictions. So assume you have an offender who's been convicted of one crime, and assume that offender served 5 years of time before his conviction was vacated. When that sentence is vacated, he's released, and that is it. We would not hand that offender a debit card and say, you've banked 5 years of time that you can spend somewhere else. And this brings me to a bigger point.
Sometimes we give them dollars. We may not give them a debit card on their sentence, but I read in the newspaper all the time, not this court, but other government entities paying prisoners for time wrongfully served. What about that?
Your Honor is correct that Wisconsin does, and other states, but Wisconsin does have a statute, 775.05, which would provide monetary compensation for an offender, but only if that offender proves that he is innocent. So the statutes providing for monetary payment are limited and would probably not apply in this case, although that's a determination that a court could make at some later point in time, as Harrison has not sought financial compensation in this case. So, yes, there is a remedy outside of a potential advancement concept, and an adoption of an advancement concept does more harm than good for the reasons that the state has listed.
What if it's in this limited context, though? So if you have a consecutive sentence, who's to say you're serving one first over the other? If someone's sentenced at the same time on two different cases, it's based on which case was filed first, but the sentences are consecutive to each other. So what's the harm there? It's not a debit card. You're not being handed something for some future get out of jail free or whatever else. What about in that limited, which maybe was what these cases originally, it was what these cases originally intended to do and maybe have been broadened past that, but what do you say about that?
So, Your Honor, I would first say that which sentence is served first is provided for by the statutes, which say that whichever sentence is imposed first is the sentence that commences running first.
If you're sentencing someone at the same time on two different cases...
Then it would
I think
the
what
imposition.
They go by is by which was filed first at that point. But it could easily be one or the other. You got two cases in front of you, you're sentencing them, you say it's consecutive. How do you know which is imposed first?
By which one that the court imposes first, I would say. So in that case, it would be governed by time. But if you had a case where it was multiple counts in a single conviction, it would be whichever count the court decided to impose first. And so getting back, though, to the main crux of your question, the reason why a court should not adopt an advancement concept is because it is only rewarding those defendants who have multiple convictions. And there are many instances where a person will sit either in confinement or as part of the service of their sentence, and we do not reward them credit. And so one example of that is a person who sits in jail pretrial and is acquitted after trial. We do not, there's no way that we can compensate that person for their time unless we were to hand them a debit card or to create a piggy bank for them that would say, you served 4 years of time awaiting for your sentence and you were acquitted. Now you have 4 years of time that you can apply somewhere else.
So because we can't do this for everybody, we shouldn't do this for the people that we could do it for?
Well, I don't think that it's fair, yes, to reward repeat offender sentences and to treat repeat offenders better than we would treat one-time offenders, acquitted persons, or persons who are serving. And so if advancement is supposed to be adopted because it is this fair concept, I would argue that it's actually not fair, because the people that it's not fair to are one-time offenders, persons who have been acquitted, and people who are serving a term of supervision when that supervision is never credited to the sentence.
Counsel, do you think that Allison matters at all in terms of, did the Court of Appeals not follow it, or do you think it's distinguishable enough? What is your thought on that?
The Court of Appeals did not follow Allison, and Allison is a binding Court of Appeals case because it is published. And so that is really a fourth argument as to why advancement should not be adopted, is because it has led to conflicting decisions in the Court of Appeals. And those decisions are this case, Zastrow, Allison, and another unpublished but authored Court of Appeals case, Van Camp. And so here's why it has led to confusion. So I'll start with Van Camp. In that case, the offender, his original conviction was vacated and he received a new sentence for a different crime. What the Court of Appeals did in Van Camp was analyze whether the time spent on the new crime had to be credited in order to accommodate double jeopardy. And so it went through the same crime analysis without reference to 973-155 and without reference to 973-04. So that's an example of the Court of Appeals doing a straight double jeopardy. Does the lack of credit in this case violate a constitutional provision?
I just want to ask one just quick follow-up. Do you think that Allison, can you state the principle that you think Allison stands for? Do you think it's a wholesale rejection of the advancement theory, or do you think it stands for something more limited than that?
Allison is a wholesale rejection of the advancement theory, as evidenced by Allison's language that it is rejecting. I think, though, you could also read Allison as saying, if an advancement concept is to be adopted, then it is only for consecutive sentences that are related. And that's where the Court of Appeals in Harrison, this case, sort of went a different direction than Allison. So in this case, the Court of Appeals concluded that these cases were not factually connected, and the state agrees with the Court of Appeals' decision on that point only. What it then said was, although we recognize that Allison says that these must be factually connected, nothing conflicts with our logic of advancing the sentences in these cases, which are unrelated. And I think that that is a direct violation of what Allison says, which is if there is to be an advancement concept, it must be for consecutive sentences that are related. The last case I would note that is one that sort of leads to the confusion that an advancement concept is creating is Zastrow. And Zastrow is an unpublished but authored case, and therefore it is citable, and it is the case that the Court of Appeals in this case relied on. And so the problem with Zastrow is that instead of applying 973-04, which would have applied in that case because the Court of Appeals concluded that he was resentenced for the same offense, it decided to advance the start date of the Outagamie cases. And in doing that, what the court did was create a scenario where it then needed to forego application of 973-04 in order to avoid awarding dual credit. It would have been dual credit on the Outagamie cases by virtue of advancing, and then credit if you applied 973-04 and attached the time served back to the Winnebago County.
Counsel, first of all, let me say, because of some back problems, I might be standing during oral argument a bit. But the reason I stood is not to really tell you that. It's to ask you a question. It seems to me that arguably the state is asking us to issue an advisory opinion. The facts that the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals relied on no longer exist, given that after the Court of Appeals decision was issued, the defendant was resentenced on the 2011 case. So why shouldn't we just vacate, or summarily vacate, the Court of Appeals decision and not issue the advisory opinion that you seem to be requesting?
Your Honor, the opinion would not be advisory. This case is in no way moot. Harrison remains very much subject to the order initially entered by the Circuit Court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals, well, reversed technically by the Court of Appeals, but only because it applied a different concept. So the reason why this case is not moot and therefore this court would not be issuing an advisory opinion is one, because Harrison remains very much subject to the order, is two, because Harrison's concession in this case that he's no longer entitled to the credit on the 2007 and 2008 sentences is in no way binding on this court. This court is free to reject or accept Harrison's new concession, and I would further point that whether Harrison is entitled to credit is a legal question, and this court resolves legal questions. So because this court is not bound, and because the court is addressing a legal question to which this court answers them, there's no reason to think that this case is moot. And even if it were, the state has provided numerous reasons why a mootness exception would occur, and this court could move forward on it. And I want to point out one additional important factual consideration, which is that Harrison is alleging that he has now been forced to concede that he's not entitled to credit because of the new sentence in the 2011 case. But it must be remembered that Harrison initially sought credit for the 2010 and 2011 cases on his 2007 and 2008 cases. And there has been no new sentence in the 2010 case. That case remains the same. It has nothing about the 2010 case has changed. And so
counsel, would our decision in this case affect the disposition of any claimed sentence credit for the 2010 case?
Yes, Your Honor. This court, at a minimum, needs to address the 2010 case, because whether this court does or does not apply it under the statutes, or does or does not an advancement concept, will directly implicate the credit that he receives for 2010.
How much time did he serve on the 2010 case?
Roughly a year plus. So he would have started serving the 2010 case on February 20th, 2014, and the 2010 case was dismissed on June 23rd, 2015.
And it was consecutive to the other cases?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to take you back to something you said about Allison and how it was totally a wholesale rejection of the advancement theory. The Court of Appeals talked about Allison because Allison characterized Tucker. And when you talk about these related offenses, Tucker was what Allison cited too, yet Tucker wasn't related offenses. So that was the rationale for the Court of Appeals to say, we understand Allison said this, but they were six separate unrelated offenses in Tucker.
Even if that were true, the Court of Appeals cannot modify or change language in Allison. That is this case, Cook v. Cook. And I would argue that the sentences in Tucker were at least procedurally related, because in Tucker, some of the sentences were recidivist sentences. So when one of the sentences fell, Tucker no longer was a third-time offender, and so the recidivist sentence that he was serving also had to disappear when the other sentences disappear. And so there was at least a procedural relationship, and while a procedural relationship is not enough in Wisconsin for an establishment of credit, it's not clear whether or not that would be enough for, I believe it was the Fourth Circuit in Tucker. And so one of the other things I would caution in this court is the reliance of other jurisdictions here, because sentence credit cases are so fact-dependent, and because Wisconsin has a sentence credit statute, a statute that governs vacated sentences, whereas other states and other jurisdictions might not have statutes governing sentence credit, they might not have a statute that governs credit for vacated sentences, and they might not even have bifurcated sentencing. And so this is very much a question of whether the legislature has spoken on the issue. The state's position is that it has through 973.155 and 973.04. And if an advancement concept is to be adopted in Wisconsin, it should be through careful consideration by the legislature, the primary policymaker in this state. I want to go back to the reasons why this court should not adopt an advancement concept, because I think that I've covered the first and the third, which is that it rewards habitual offenders and it encourages courts to forego application of 973.04. That was in my discussion of Zastrow. That's where the court had to forego 973.04 because it would provide for dual credit. And I want to go to my second reason, which is that this court should not adopt an advancement concept because it conflicts with our bifurcated sentencing structure. So as this court knows, our courts sentence a person to a period of initial confinement and a period of extended supervision. And extended supervision is an important component of a sentence, as demonstrated by the legislature's mandate that it may not be less than 25% of the length of a term of confinement. The supervision component of a sentence focuses on the rehabilitation of the defendant and the protection of the community, and that includes a person's successful reintegration back into the community. And one way that we try to ensure that a person successfully reintegrates is by placing conditions of supervision on that person, which are tailored to that person's individual needs. If, as here, A term of confinement is credited towards a period of supervision. A defendant moves back into the community without any supervision or conditions designed to help him successfully reintegrate and designed to keep the community safe. That's potentially dangerous, and it likely thwarts the circuit court's intent at sentencing, and it does nothing to satisfy the dual goals of rehabilitation and protection of the community.
Let's talk a little bit about extended supervision. If an offender is on their last day of extended supervision and violates, can they go to prison or jail for one day?
No, Your Honor.
How does that work?
The person would go through a revocation process and potentially receive a revocation sentence. And what is important about Your Honor's question...
What's the maximum sentence that person could receive?
I believe it's whatever is left on the maximum term of the sentence as provided by the statute.
So, for example, just because someone's sentenced to 3 years of initial confinement and 2 years of extended supervision, that could be a much longer term of being under the government's control than 5 years, right? 5 years wouldn't be the end date if you violated on the last day of your extended supervision period. You could go back for that additional couple of years, right?
Yes. And what's really important about what Your Honor is asking is that when a person serves their probation, their extended supervision, their parole, up until that last day, and on that last day is revoked, we do not credit that person with the time that they spent serving the probation, the extended supervision, or the parole. That's another circumstance where a person will either be confined or will be serving a portion of their sentence or probation, and we do not account for that credit.
Counsel, I want to talk a little bit about the 2010 conviction because I find that the hardest one. That was vacated in January of 2015.
Yes.
Okay, and he began serving time on that in August of 2014.
No, Your Honor. So he would have begun the 2010 case on February 20th, 2014, which is the day that his initial confinement in the 2008 case ran.
Okay.
Thanks to the sentence adjustment that he received from the circuit court.
Okay, so it's 2014.
Yes.
So that conviction was vacated, but he's not been retried. So right now, that's just a nothing?
Your Honor, that case has been dismissed. Yes,
okay.
So that case is a nothing.
Okay.
And I want to be clear that if Harrison did not...
Just back up. I had other dates from you previously. I thought that was the one that you said there's 1 year plus credit. It's from February 20, 2014, but it was dismissed June 23rd, 2015.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. And what is really important is that if Harrison did not have his 2007 and 2008 sentences or his 2011 sentence, his revived 2011 sentence, there would be nothing that we would do. Harrison would just be released. So that this is an instance purely where we are rewarding a habitual offender with credit that we would not award to someone else absent them having another sentence.
Okay, but if I understand what you're saying is we just can ignore that conviction. That's nothing that we need to be concerned about here. But that conviction, wasn't it concurrent with the 2011?
No, Your Honor. So
was it consecutive?
Yes.
Okay,
and
good.
So the
Thank
state's
you.
Position is that when the 2010 sentence was vacated, that is the moment at which the 2011 sentence commenced.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you. Thank you for that help.
Welcome. Again, the state would just ask that this court conclude that Harrison is not entitled to credit under the statutes, and that because an advancement concept would lead to troublesome consequences, that this court issue a substantive decision reversing the Court of Appeals' decision.
And that's just in relationship to this 2007 and 2008 convictions, correct?
Yes. So the interesting posture of Harrison's case is that he is trying to attach credit from his 2010 and 2011 periods of confinement to his extended supervision in his 2007 and 2008 cases.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
May Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am Assistant State Public Defender Jeremy Newman, and I represent Richard H. Harrison, Jr. Based on the facts and record before this court, there is no non-frivolous argument that my client is entitled to the sentence credit granted by the circuit court or the advancement of his extended supervision ordered by the Court of Appeals. The state agrees that Harrison is entitled to no such credit or no such relief. Because this court does not issue advisory opinions based on facts not before it, this court should summarily reverse the Court of Appeals decision and remand this case to the circuit court with directions to deny Harrison's sentence credit claim.
I have a question. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. What do we do about the 2010 case? Because that is still something that's been, he did serve time. It's been vacated, and under the theory you offered initially, that's still an issue.
What I would say first is that the issue this court has to decide is whether or not Harrison is entitled to any relief, whether sentence credit or advancement of his ES in the 2007 and 2008 cases before this court. At this point, he is not, because he was resentenced in the 2011 case. Because the 2011 case was resentenced, and that does exist now, but the 2010 case doesn't, sort of going back to Harrison's argument below, and the basis for both the circuit court's and the Court of Appeals' relief, is that that 2010 case has to be treated as if it, you know, as this court held in Lamar, that it's null and void, that it's treated as if it didn't exist for many reasons and, for the most part, for sentence computation purposes. So it's always been Harrison's position from the circuit court up until now that any time he technically spent in connection with the 2010 sentence in prison, when that was vacated and when it was never reimposed, when that case was dismissed, that case is gone, so we ignore it.
So you're not asking for advancement with respect to 2010? Okay.
No. Harrison's position is that once he was resentenced in the 2011 case, which the court clarified earlier was consecutive to the 2010 case, that Harrison's claim for any sort of credit related to the 2010 case, you know, essentially evaporated.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, were you done, Justice?
I just wanted to know why. And then I'm done, and thank you.
Yeah.
Or because the 2011 case was ordered similar to Harrison's argument with respect to both, you know, it's essentially the same argument with respect to both cases, that once either and or both of these sentences were vacated, they have to be treated as if they never existed. So that's still true with the 2010 case. When the 2011 sentence comes back, when he's resentenced for that, it is Harrison's position, even though it's not actually an issue for this court to decide in these cases, that 2011 sentence goes back towards, you know, when Harrison would have otherwise been released onto extended supervision in these cases.
And not on the 2010 case.
No, because that case doesn't exist, and it's like we essentially legally we pretend that it didn't exist.
Okay. All right.
So counsel, do you believe? I mean, you're asking us to reverse the Court of Appeals decision. And I'm thinking about how something like that would look. Presumably, we have to say it was wrong in some way. Do you think there was an error by the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals in giving you what you asked for?
Yeah, I think the simple answer and the most direct answer is that it's wrong now as we stand right here because the facts changed. So when Harrison was resentenced, that, you know, it's at least Harrison's position that was a significant fact. It was the underlying basis for his claim from the circuit court up until he was resentenced. So all this court really, I think, needs to and should say is that Harrison is not entitled to the sentence credit granted by the circuit court, and he's not entitled to the advancement of his extended supervision ordered by the Court of Appeals because he has a sentence in the 2011 case, which sort of the lack thereof was the entire basis, sort of the foundational basis for any relief that he granted or sought. If for example, Harrison had, if he had been immediately had his conviction vacated or his sentence vacated, and on the same date, which happens fairly often, actually, has a new sentence reimposed immediately. If that would have happened under this basic, this the same timeline, let's say ignore the 2010 case for a second. In 2017, when the federal court granted his habeas relief, if he would have been immediately somehow resentenced in that case, there would have been no, you know, intermittent time where Harrison would have sort of been in leeway or been in limbo, where it wouldn't have been certain what was going on with that time that he spent in prison. And Harrison would have never, he never would have or could have pursued any sort of non-frivolous claim that he was entitled to credit on the earlier imposed sentences.
So in a situation like this, if you have a vacated sentence and vacated conviction, and then you go back and ask for this advancement theory, should courts give that, or should they wait until there's some determination on what's going to happen to the later events under your approach?
Sure. So, I mean, maybe this is a good, you know, example of where comparing the 2010 case to the 2011 case, you know, I guess helps answer your question. When the case is, you know, when a sentence or conviction is vacated, then it's, say it's immediately dismissed, you know, let's assuming it's with prejudice and there's 0% chance that that's going to come back, then there's no uncertainty. Then, you know, either he's entitled to credit for that time or he's not. One way or the other, it's never going to change. However, you know, it is often the case that sentences or convictions are vacated and then they're not either immediately dismissed or, you know, a new sentence is not immediately reimposed. And I think what our case law holds is that we can't deny somebody credit because at some point down the road, they might or likely or possibly might receive a sentence that might, you know, might be where this time really should go.
Is it your position that your client received credit or not?
In the circuit court, he did. He sought and received credit.
Right.
And that's what the, if it would have ended there, the DOC would have, by the circuit court's order, had to treat that time that he spent in prison as if he was in prison in connection with the 2007 and 2008 cases. In the Court of Appeals, you know, the reason why Harrison petitioned or cross-petitioned for review was that advancing his ES date is not the same as giving him credit. I think Justice Ziegler was getting to this issue earlier, you know, and I made note of this in the cross-petition and I believe other places as well, certainly below, but there's a significant difference between giving somebody credit or some way treating that as time spent in confinement versus, you know, essentially what the Court of Appeals did is agree with Harrison on the merits and the substance, not necessarily on the 973-155 sentence credit claim. And its relief was better than nothing. So Harrison didn't completely disagree with it. But it would have treated that time that Harrison spent in prison, those rough, a little less than 3 years, as if he was serving ES, extended supervision, where he was in fact in prison. And that, I mean, at a very foundational level, that was the basis for the claim. That was the basis for his PFR. And the difference is that if Harrison, like Justice Ziegler was alluding to, if he was revoked on the last day of his supervision, you know, the original sentences were 3 in, 3 out, 6 years. If you treat that time that Harrison spent in prison when he should have been released to extended supervision as not confinement and just supervision, he could have been sent back to prison for 3 full years. And that would have resulted in him serving 3 years initial confinement, roughly 3 years on this, on these other cases that are vacated, and then an additional 3 years reconfinement because he violated the conditions. And that was the basic, you know, underlying argument that we made. It's just that that all changed when he was resentenced, and he can no longer claim that those 3 years that he spent in prison are not connected to any other lawful sentence.
Could you help me clear up just a little bit of confusion on the 10 and 11 cases? My confusion. So when he was, when Mr. Harrison was resentenced on the 2011 case, did he request sentence credit for time served with respect to the 2010 case?
I think all this record shows, and it's part of the plea agreement that was filed in that court and which was supplemented for the record in this case, is that the parties, and I don't think it was, you know, it's not fully explained in this record. I don't think it's clear yet, and to some extent, you know, that's an issue to be resolved or potentially litigated in Ashland County. But I think all that's on the record is that the parties sort of punted to DOC under 97304 to determine credit. Like, whether or not that's the way it should have happened or whether or not there was other explanations for why that happened that way, you know, it's not part of this record, as far as I'm aware. So I think technically on the record, he didn't ask for it. He didn't, you know, the parties essentially stipulated that the DOC will figure this out. There is a brief discussion from Harrison's trial counsel that, you know, that there might be disagreement between the parties and the DOC about what credit he is entitled to under that statute, and we might, you know, Harrison's trial counsel or Harrison might end up back in Ashland County to fight about that. So it's somewhat unclear, but I guess just to get around to your question, he hasn't, I guess, formally in that case. I'm not hiding our position or Harrison's position at this point that, yes, Harrison does believe, and there's, you know, there is still a basis to seek the credit in the 2011 case or credit for that time he spent in prison from roughly 2014 through 2017 against the sentence that was recently reimposed in Ashland County because that's where it went originally, and that's where it should go in the end of all this. If that's all that happens, that's where it should go.
And if he does not receive credit for the time served for the 2010 conviction, wouldn't the Court of Appeals opinion in this case suggest that the sentence for the 2011 case be advanced?
I'm sorry, can you restate that again? I'm trying to follow.
So let's say that Mr. Harrison does not receive any credit in the 2011 case for the time served in the 2010 case.
Okay, so that roughly year time that we're talking about.
Year, it looks like a year and 3 months.
Sure.
Wouldn't the Court of Appeals opinion in this case suggest that the 2011 sentence be advanced?
Honestly, I think that's the way the Court of Appeals decision would have to be read, assuming that was the final outcome of the Ashland County case, which obviously doesn't have a final decision yet or, you know, final sort of resting place.
Okay. Thank you.
So, I mean, to some extent, I follow the question. I understand sort of the uncertainty about it. To some extent, I am just as uncertain about it because it depends on something happening later on that I don't know what or you know, I don't know what's going to happen next in that case either.
Counsel, I'd like you to help me with the interpretation of the statute 973-155. And that in sub 1A says a convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence, and now I come to the important language, for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. Okay. Now, as I understand it, initially, of course, he was seeking credit for the 2007-2008 mm-hmm. sentence, but he was seeking credit for based on the 2010 and 11 convictions. So if that is correct, how does that comport with the plain language of the statute, all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which the sentence was imposed?
Sure. So, and this was admitted in the Court of Appeals brief that this is not the straightforward standard sentence credit case. To some extent, I think it still was and is, at least up until the resentencing in Ashland County, sentence credit in the sense that Harrison was entitled to and is entitled to credit against his sentence for the time he spent in custody. So I think what's, the basis for Harrison's claim in the Court of Appeals and up until this new sentencing, it was in some part based on 973-155, the sentence credit statute. But there are other sentencing statutes that are relevant and were relevant to Harrison's sentence.
Yes,
so,
but how do you get around the plain language of 973-155?
So there's no dispute that Harrison was in custody. So that prong is met. The state has never argued that. The question is whether it's factually connected with the course of conduct from the 2007-2008 cases. So, it's essentially relying on the in-custody portion of the 973-155, and to some extent, this court's decision in State v. Lamar and the principle that a vacated sentence is null and void, that we treat it as if it never existed, especially for sentence computation purposes. And when you do that, that was the basis for the Court of Appeal or for the Circuit Court's decision, and to some extent for the Court of Appeals decision, because there are other sentencing statutes, 973-115, and 302-113(4), which sentences commence on noon on the date they were imposed. They run continuously unless interrupted by some lawful order, either by the court or, for example, a stay, or in this case, by an order, first the Clark County and then the Ashland County case, or Ashland County courts, that those sentences would be made consecutive to these two Clark County concurrent sentences. So that's a lawful basis to essentially delay or interrupt Harrison's service of his three in, three out. And under the statute, he was required, when all of these sentences existed, to serve three in on each of the 2007-2008 cases, and then serve the initial confinement portion of the 2010 case. And then when the 2011 sentence came around, to serve that initial confinement portion, and only then would he have reached his extended supervision date and begun serving the 3N and then ES in the 2010 and then the 2011. So when Harrison litigated this in the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, no new sentence had been imposed in either the 2010 or 2011 cases. So his request was under the other sentencing statutes, essentially, to give him credit for that time because he was in custody, and he would have otherwise been released from custody but for these vacated sentences. And so when those are vacated, we simply go back to how these sentences would have run if they had never existed. And it's undisputed that had nothing else existed, Harrison, he would have been on extended supervision. The only thing holding him in any sort of custody, whether it's prison or supervision under the control of the Department of Corrections, were these 2007-2008 cases. So it's undisputed that he was in custody during that time, and there would have been no other basis to hold him in custody. So that time would have been creditable against essentially the service of that sentence because he didn't escape and because there was no other basis, based on a valid sentence or a valid order that would have otherwise held him in custody. At the same time, and what I would agree with the state on at the end of the day is that this court does need to decide whether or not Harrison is entitled to any sort of relief here, whether it's sentence credits, as he, sought and received in the Circuit Court, or whether it's this advancement of his extended supervision that the Court of Appeals gave. But all the court needs to do with that and the parties agree that there's no claim for credit or advancement of his ES at this time. So it's, you know, the case isn't moot in the sense that a decision will have no impact. It's just that there's no actual fight about whether or not, or no live controversy about whether or not Harrison is, you know, today, and, you know, immediately after he was sentenced in Ashland County in the 2011 case, whether he's entitled to anything.
Doesn't it provide some service, though? I mean, essentially, you went to court, you got what you wanted, and now you're coming and saying, I no longer got what I wanted, but you and the state disagree about why. Isn't there some value to us explaining why?
Well, I guess I would take some issue with the, I guess, the part of the question where he didn't get what he wanted. He did get what he wanted when...
That's what I'm saying. He got what he wanted.
Sure.
And now you're saying you no longer want what you got.
So I think that this would
just say why.
Yeah, so I think it would be a different question if Harrison just simply changed his mind and just willy-nilly said, actually, no, like I just don't want this anymore. I don't care about it or I don't want it. You know, that's not what happened here. There was this undisputed new event that fundamentally altered Harrison's entire claim for credit. So it's not just that he decided to change positions or decided to, you know, for whatever reason, decide that he didn't want the credit here. He simply, based on this new fact, concluded that he has no basis to even argue for the credit. So I think it's different from a situation where a party just changes their mind, or which, you know, happens, you know, in some of the cases that the state cited, you know, in opposition to the motion for summary reversal, that, you know, sometimes this court isn't bound by concessions. Harrison isn't telling the court that you must summarily reverse or that you must agree that he's not entitled to any relief. That is Harrison's position. That is the state's position, that he is not entitled to any of that. And, you know, I guess it's not that the court can't talk about Harrison's entitlement to credit as it existed before the new sentence or the resentence. You know, the sentence was reimposed in Ashland County. It's just that it's not necessary. And, you know, it's Harrison's position that it would be an advisory opinion because it's not based on the facts actually before this court.
So why did the resentencing in the 2011 case affect your claim for sentence credit based on the 2010 case?
Yes, so Harrison's, because the claim, I guess the argument always was that Harrison was entitled to credit for all of that time from his, you know, what would have been his extended supervision date, mm-hmm, of February 20th or whatever it is, 2014, up until when he was released from prison.
And, so you, Harrison, got that.
That's what he got in the form of sentence credit and then the advancement of the ES in the Court of Appeals.
Yeah. So now you get resentenced on 2011 case. So why does that affect what you asked for with respect to the 2010 time?
Because the 2010 case doesn't exist, you know, Harrison's position has always been that we essentially ignore that time and the 2000, or whether it's, I guess whether it's the 2007 and 2008 cases sort of continuing running as if nothing came after, or whether now it's, you know, essentially Harrison's potential claim in the Ashland County case credit should be credited with all the time that he spent in prison back through February 2014.
So let me sharpen this up a little bit. So when you're in front of the circuit court, you say, take the 2010 and 2011 time, and we're going to advance the sentence, right? So now you get that. You get resentenced on 2011, and now your position is, well, wait a minute. Even though we were just resentenced on the 2011 case, that affects our argument with respect to both the 2011 time and the 2010 time. Is that right?
I guess I don't see there being any change in position from what Harrison sought in the circuit court and then in the Court of Appeals, seeking credit for all of this time because nothing existed. And now when something existed, which at this point, the 2011 case, it was made consecutive. I don't recall exactly whether it was explicitly made consecutive to the these two Clark County cases or just anything that was previously imposed. The only things that are previously imposed relevant here are the 2007 and 2008 cases, because there is no 2010 case or sentence, you know, in terms of talking about sentence computation. So maybe we just disagree about whether that's consistent or not, but it's Harrison's position that that was always the position, that that those roughly 3 years were always available for either the 2007 and 2008 cases, or now for the 2011 case, because it was made consecutive to these cases. So it would, assuming that relief was eventually obtained, it would go all the way back to when these sentences would have reached their extended supervision date.
If we rejected the advancement theory, would it affect the arguments that you make for your client going forward?
Could you explain? I'm trying to follow or imagine.
If we rejected the advancement theory, would that affect the arguments that you make moving forward in seeking credit for your client, seeking any kind of credit?
Honestly, I would like to answer, but I just don't know. I mean, nothing has happened in the Ashland County case, and to the extent that to the extent that the court rejects the advancement theory and says that there's no basis for that, or however the court were to do that, presumably he would, Harrison would not be entitled to any relief. The Court of Appeals already rejected the sentence credit claim itself, so sort of the status of his case would be that time, at least, I think all the court can say is that time can't go towards the 2007-2008 cases. So I think to some extent that would leave it for another day, whether under 973-04 or a combination of 973-04 and 973-155, which this court, which is how this court interpreted those two statutes in State v. Lamar, that they're read together. So it's not necessarily an either-or thing. I think if this court were to reject the advancement theory and deny Harrison, essentially reverse the Court of Appeals decision on that issue, it would leave open that time for Harrison to seek in the 2011 case. Okay, if there are no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with Justice Hagedorn's question, because yes, I do believe that if this court concludes that an advancement concept should not be adopted in Wisconsin, it would directly impact what Harrison could argue that he's entitled to in the revived 2011 case, and here's why. So Harrison's 2010 and 2011 cases are not going to be factually connected. He's not going to be able to seek Section 973-155 credit for that reason. So what that will leave him with is an argument that his revived 2011 sentence for causing mental harm to a child should be backdated to start on February 20th, 2014, which is the date that the 2010 initial confinement time started by virtue of the 2008 confinement time ending.
Say that again. That's kind of the whole point of asking for a summary reversal, right?
Could I ask her to say that again?
Let me clarify for you, Chief. So, what will happen is that Harrison will not be entitled to Section 973-155 credit because there's not a factual connection between his 2010 and 2011 sentences.
Okay.
So what he will want to argue below in a revived 2011 circuit court case is that his 2011 revived 2011 sentence started on February 20th, 2014, which is the date that his 2010 case started. So what he will be asking for is advancement of his revived 2011 sentence to the date that it would have started but for the 2010 sentence.
Okay, good. And thank you.
That brings me to Lamar.
That's the whole point of seeking a summary reversal here, right, is so that we take this time off the 2007 and 8 cases and make that 2010 time available for the 2011 case without saying anything substantive about the advancement theory. Right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and that's one of the main reasons that the state has been pushing this court to issue a substantive decision. This case is important because if this court does not overrule the Court of Appeals' decision and undo Harrison's current advancement, he will not be able to go back and seek the credit in the revived 2011 case, because just like in Zastrow then, that will result in the award of impermissible dual credit. And so a substantive decision is very much needed here, because what is happening is that the Court of Appeals is advancing offender sentences and then foregoing application of 97304. We would not be here if what had happened was that Harrison had not moved for sentence credit on his 2007 2008 cases and had instead waited until he was sentenced in the revived 2011 case. And I just want to be clear about one point, which is that we all knew that the revived 2011 sentence was coming. The day after the district court for the state of Wisconsin reversed his conviction, the parties went to court that day. So everyone knew that he was going to be re-prosecuted. We didn't know the exact sentence that he was going to receive necessarily, but we knew he was going to be re-prosecuted, and we knew that he was going to receive a new sentence. And Harrison has never argued that it is the specific sentence structure that matters in his argument. It's only that a new sentence has happened. And again, I would just remind the court that Harrison has always sought credit from the 2010 and 2011 cases to apply to the 07 and 08 cases. And his logic for why this court can no longer consider the 2011 case simply does not apply to the 2010 case. So at a minimum, this court will need to address whether or not Harrison is entitled to credit or advancement on the 2010 case. And one other thing I'd like to make clear is what this court actually said in Lamar. This court said that to vacate means to nullify or cancel, to make void, invalidate. Harrison's 2010 and 2011 sentences became void on the day that the courts reversed them. They were not always void. They were once lawful sentences that became void once the courts concluded that in this court's case, his right to statutory substitution was violated, and in the federal case, that the courts had misapplied Strickland. And I also want to put Lamar in context. So the reason why Lamar used such strong language when it comes to the word void is because the dissent was trying to argue that because the first sentence had been imposed concurrent and then the revived sentence had been imposed consecutive, that we should still take that time and apply it to the now consecutive sentence. And this court wanted to clearly reject that. And I would just thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both for very interesting arguments. Usually sentence credit cases are a little bit of a yawn, to be quite frank. But this one is very, very interesting, and it brings us new concepts and fine arguments and all. We are now going to adjourn, and those of you who can't, Justice Hagedorn will come down and chat. We are adjourned.